while I love trying new styles, I feel like fashion changes faster than I can keep up. Not to mention, I am not a fan of dressing rooms. These are just a couple of reasons why I love renting many of my clothes. Enter Armoire. Armoire allows you to rent high-quality designer clothing for any occasion. I signed up. I took a style quiz, and they offer suggestions that best match me. So whether you're planning a date night, packing for a conference, headed to a black tie event, you have the perfect outfit without facing a dressing room with fluorescent lights. With my Armoire clothing rental, I feel brave trying new styles because I know it's not forever, just a week or a month. And my favorite thing, having someone else do my laundry when I'm ready for new clothes. Right now, our gems can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off their first month. And that is up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/hiddentruecrime. That's armoire.style. So armoire.style/hiddentruecrime to get up to 50% off your first month and never worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today. Artifact Uprising is a company that John and I have used to preserve our most special family memories for years. Artifact Uprising is driven by the same belief we hold, that everyone has a story to tell, and they tell these stories through premium quality albums and prints. We purchased their signature Lay Flat album 8 years ago for our wedding album, and when our son was born, we purchased the same album again to preserve his milestones. Artifact Uprising now wants to help our gems preserve your meaningful moments this holiday season. Whether you want a photo to hang and display or an album with impeccable quality and design to cherish for years to come, we've trusted Artifact Uprising with preserving our most cherished memories and telling our family story from the moment John and I met. And they encourage you to tell your story too. Through the end of the year, Hidden True Crime listeners can give Artifact Uprising a try and get 20% off for new customers, or 15% off if you have purchased before. Just visit artifactuprising.com and use code Hidden True Crime through December 31st. This episode that we are about to listen to was originally recorded in August of 2023. It was after Janie Crosdale's body was discovered in a blue barrel, but before there were any murder charges for Timothy Hazlett. It was also during a time when Rex Huerman was recently arrested and charged with the Gilgo Beach serial killings. We saw many parallels between Rex Huerman and Timothy Hazlett, and wanted to explore those while we awaited the continuing police investigation. We also discuss in this episode a letter, a handwritten letter that Timothy Hazlett wrote, which he requested continued contact with his young son. Hello, Hidden Gems. John and I have been talking a lot. We know a lot more about who Timothy Hazlett is. I wonder that we are possibly looking at a serial killer. We know that he built the room in his house, right? So we have years, right, John? I mean, we have years of having this home in his basement garage that he built, this homemade torture chamber.
Right. The room was built in early 2020. And then the first known victim escapes in October of 2022. So you're talking about well over 2 years with a room that seems to be specifically constructed for the purpose of harming victims, or at least torturing or holding victims captive. So I would presume that a room like this, built for a specific purpose, probably housed more than two victims. But again, we don't know for sure. He has not been charged with her murder at this point. You know, obviously he hasn't been tried either. So at this point, everything is alleged and speculative, but certainly having a large number of blue barrels at your house with a victim who runs screaming out of your basement with a collar around her neck saying that, you know, I escaped, he killed my friends. That doesn't look good, but, you know, but yes, it has to be proven in a court of law.
Janie Crosdale's sister allegedly told a paper that she had last heard from Janie in August of 2022. And we know that TJ, the woman that escaped, states that she had been held since the beginning of September.
You and I were talking earlier about some comparisons with Lisk or the Long Island serial killer. So I think that's an interesting place to begin for a lot of reasons.
We feel this is really important right now when it comes to Lisk. We're seeing all these parallels with Rex Huerman.
where they are possibly targeting such sex workers or just women or victims that are in very vulnerable positions.
You just mentioned a really obvious parallel, which is the, I don't know what to call it, quiet room, the torture chamber room, the whatever. The LISC apparently had a similar room too. Actually, with Timothy Hazlitt, it seems more clear cut that there was this room that was built specifically for that purpose. But with Rex Huerman, he had some kind of room that had 3-foot concrete walls to reinforce it. So clearly he didn't want anyone to hear what was going on in there. You know, maybe this is a cliche for anyone who watches Netflix films about murderers. They always have these types of rooms, right? But certainly they both seem to have a room like this. They both targeted very vulnerable, available women that probably some level they believed were a low priority for law enforcement and that law enforcement wouldn't really go out of their way to find. So one of the terms I've heard for vulnerable women or, you know, sex workers that go missing is they're sometimes referred to as the missing. It's one thing to go missing, but the missing are generally the victims that are given low priority or little attention. And I think that in this particular case, I think there's a lot of reasons Timothy Hazlitt focused on this group specifically, but certainly one of the reasons was that he probably believed, like Rex Huerman, that they wouldn't be given a high priority, as Bishop Caldwell pointed out. So I think that he knew that, and that was probably part of his decision to focus on that group, or one of the reasons he focused on that group. And to get a little deeper into that issue, there's a lot of reasons that that group is targeted, not just being vulnerable. They're sort of a low priority for law enforcement in the community. I mean, maybe law enforcement would disagree with me, but historically that's been somewhat true. The population of women that are, you know, sex workers tend to be somewhat transient. Many of them have substance abuse problems, so they sort of move in and out of communities or society. Also, their DNA tends to be hard to, you know, the DNA of these types of victims tends to be hard to identify, because if they're with multiple people in a night or over a period of days, then how do you separate out? How do you find DNA that might identify the victim? I think with Hazlitt, perhaps that's different because he held these people captive. The bodies in these particular cases tend to be moved to other locations. Oftentimes they're moved to other jurisdictions. And because of that, you have confusion over who has priority, who's in charge of that jurisdiction. You know, the bodies of this particular population are moved. A lot of times they're decomposed. They're hard to find. A lot of times they'll sit in really remote locations for many years. So, you know, there's so many reasons why this particular group is vulnerable and why, in many cases, serial killers might want to target that group. I think it gives them a better chance potentially to get away with murder. So, you know, even like with Huerman was seemingly putting his victims in a fairly similar area, but he wasn't, it seems as if the crimes were occurring at his house. But by moving the body to a different location, you're disrupting the crime scene. You're changing the dynamics of the crime scene, and you're making it much more difficult to figure out what's going on, especially if the crime scene is altered or cleaned or changed in any way. And obviously, when you take a body from a crime scene, you're really transforming law enforcement's ability to solve the crime. So, and in these types of cases, the bodies are almost always moved, or they're disfigured, or I don't know. You know, it's interesting in the case of Tim Hazlitt, these barrels were plastic, and we have some, you and I have learned and have some indication that he had acid, a specific type of acid at his home, which for anybody who's watched Breaking Bad or just followed true crime for that matter, plastic barrels with a specific type of acid usually means that bodies are being dissolved. And so if you want to completely eliminate evidence and a body for that matter, it's conceivable that you would get these types of barrels to do that.
Kathleen, thank you. She states, this is so horrific, using dog collars and torture. This is more than just killing. Yeah. This guy is a sadist, I think.
Yeah. Well, you know, Bishop Caldwell had a really good point, which is that he said that, I don't know if he used this term, but there's certainly a huge element of dehumanization here. To treat victims and forget about the color of their skin, but to treat any victim in this manner is so dehumanizing and so horrific. I noticed that there was a little discussion about race in the chat, and we might get into that a little later. But, you know, I think it's obviously very relevant in this case because that's who he's targeting. And it's relevant because Tim Hazlitt has a number of posts on social media where he says really racist things, and he makes it clear that he's racist. So
He stated himself. Yeah, he makes it clear on social media. Yes.
So if you're targeting black women and you're making racist comments and you're showing that you're a racist who hates black women, race is relevant.
Right. And we've talked to several people who knew Timothy Hazlitt. And one thing that they repeat to me and to us is that they state he did not like that he was a racist. He did not like black people and he did not like women. He was a misogynist and a racist. And that has now come from multiple sources. So.
Right. So I think if you want to look at a case like this objectively, you have to consider that to be an important element. Otherwise, you're whitewashing it, so to speak. You're ignoring certain facts that are critical to these crimes. Whether that's pleasant to someone or not, that's not up to me to determine. But my job is to just try to look at the evidence and the facts and make an objective analysis of someone's psychological state.
We've learned a lot about Timothy Hazlitt, including his past. But we've also talked to many, many people behind the scenes as well. We've learned a lot about his upbringing, his childhood, a mother who died of drug addiction and a stepmother. What do you want to share right now that you think is important, John? I know you don't want to share everything.
Yeah. So since I'm talking about Huerman a little bit, let's jump in with some more comparisons. So one of the things we know about Timothy Hazlitt is, like Huerman, there was some bullying going on. It seems like with Timothy Hazlitt, the bullying was in middle school, high school. It seemed to be mostly verbal and emotional, bullying. He was ostracized quite a bit. He was a loner in high school. He did apparently have a girlfriend for several years in high school. But other than that, he was widely considered to be a bit of a misfit and an outcast. And so, again, very similar to Huerman. We know that Timothy Hazlitt, and I think this is probably the most relevant, is his mother was a drug addict. She later died of a drug overdose. So his biological mother had him until the age of 12. And the other thing about living with his mother was apparently she had a history of abusive relationships. He would witness those. So whether or not Timothy Hazlitt was actually caught in the middle of the crossfire in those relationships or physically abused by some of her mother's boyfriends, we don't know. He's been really, apparently, he's very, very reluctant, apparently, to discuss his relationship with his biological mother. He doesn't speak poorly of her. But we do know that there was a lot of domestic violence when Timothy Hazlitt was growing up. We do know that his mother was an addict. And it's interesting that in domestic violence types of relationships and childhoods, many times children are deeply affected, but some children react quite differently to those types of environments. And we've also learned that Tim Hazlitt apparently saw his father as a bit of a wimp. And so that's relevant in the sense that I don't know if his father was abusive to the mother. It doesn't sound like it. It sounds like it was other boyfriends. But it's relevant in the sense that sometimes in these types of abusive childhoods, the men or the males or the boys, they will vow to, well, a couple of things happen. They oftentimes blame the women for being weak. They blame their mothers for being weak and not standing up to the abusers. But then over time, there's a shift and they start identifying with the aggressors or they start identifying more with the abusers. And I think Tim Hazlitt, by seeing his father as being somewhat wimpy, or I forget the term that we heard, but that he's angry at his father because he wished that he had a strong male figure in his life and he doesn't and he didn't. And at some point there's the shift from being angry at his mother for being abused, I think, to identification with the aggressor, where he blames his mother for being weak and he wants to be seen as strong, right? So he starts to occupy that more masculine kind of macho male role over time. And he starts really disliking or developing a great deal of anger towards women that begins with his mother. My guess is that these domestic violence relationships that Tim Hazlitt experienced repeatedly probably play a really important role in these later crimes.
As Terry Hammond states, it seems to always be the case with people like him: bullying, hard home life, mommy or daddy issues. These are all factors that make people into the people they are. And we discuss this a lot with Rex Huerman too, Lisk, or the Long Island serial killer. There are a lot of similar things we've heard. And this is coming from other people, guys. This is we're hearing this from his history. People are sharing this with us. And so I just keep turning to John saying, this sounds so similar to what you've been saying about Rex Heuermann. It's just been so odd for me to actually hear it from people saying he was bullied and this happened, a broken home life. They both lost parents.
With Rex Heuermann, I think it was more about his dad seems to be the one who was aggressive, and his dad was overly critical of him. And so I think he sort of internalized this emasculated sense of self that he wasn't ever good enough. I think with Timothy Hazlitt, he probably had a lot of anger toward his mother for maybe not protecting him, but also for taking the abuse, for being in these relationships repeatedly. And so initially, a lot of children will feel some compassion for their mothers or try to protect them when they're younger. But then over time, they often see their mothers as being weak for taking the abuse and for getting in these relationships repeatedly. So a lot of times you'll see a shift where they begin to identify more with the aggressive males and they begin to really dislike women. And I think he probably has anger towards his dad. He sees his dad as being, you know, not a strong male. And so perhaps he, even though his father wasn't with his mother during those early years, he might blame his father for leaving his mother or for not being the strong male that he needed, or maybe he was never the strong male he needed. I think there's probably a lot of elements, components to that story.
Two questions that I think about when it comes to Rex. They both lost a parent at a young age, each a different parent. Timothy Hazlitt lost his mother. Rex lost his father. Does that play a part in this?
Yeah, for sure. I think grief at a young age. They both lost parents around the same age, 11, 12-ish. Unresolved grief can lead a tremendous wound. And it's very difficult sometimes for, especially, you know, children like Timothy Hazlitt that have experienced all this violence around them. It's difficult for them to really kind of repair that wound and to make sense of the world at such a young age when the person that's supposed to nurture and protect them all of a sudden is gone.
I have heard, you know, both of them, I have heard that Timothy Hazlitt actually would not say anything negative about his birth mother.
Yeah.
Despite her, I'm sure she wasn't perfect. She was an addict. She struggled herself. And Rex Heuermann took care of his mother, or sort of like the man in the house, and bought his childhood home even from her.
I don't know if he took care of her. I think my understanding is she was very controlling and overbearing. So I think she was demanding and sort of forced him to come home right after school. And I think he buys the childhood home probably for a lot of reasons, but some of it probably has to do with his father, that he had a lot of memories of his father. And his father had a lot of stuff, a lot of memorabilia in the home, and he wanted to keep it there, I think. So I think they're a little different, but certainly that loss at an early age can create a lot of trauma for children. And, you know, with Timothy Hazlitt, you're adding trauma upon trauma. You've got violent relationships. The mother's involved in a series of violent relationships during his childhood, and then he loses her. So you're just stacking trauma upon trauma.
Both Rex and Timothy had been divorced. They were at different places in their life when arrested. So Timothy was in his 30s when he was arrested, but had been divorced from his son's mother. A lot of people are asking about his son. I want to say that I have heard the son is safe with his mother. So the child is in good hands, and she's a good person, is taking care of him. But he was divorced from her. Rex had also been divorced. He remarried and then was still married when he was arrested. But I've also wondered about that divorce from women in their lives, and if that added to any anger or what that might do to have a divorce like that.
Yeah, it's a failure. You know, I think one thing we know about Timothy Hazlitt is that he felt like he could never connect to women, that he could never sustain a relationship or a significant relationship. And I'm sure that was a part of his anger, that he really, like Rex Heuermann, he really seemed to struggle with social skills and social competence. And, you know, and consequently, both of them were, for the most part, loners. I mean, yes, they were married. Well, Timothy Hazlitt was married but divorced. They were, you know, Rex Heuermann was married at the end, but I'm not sure he was close to his wife. Seems to me like there wasn't a lot of happiness in that home. I think that it seems like the family that was together in that home was very disconnected. So even though he was married, he still seems very much like a loner, and he's clearly leading a double life. So the commonality is that they both are very much misfits to some degree. They're both loners. I think Rex Heuermann has more education and he's more of a professional in his work. Tim Hazlitt's more of a blue collar guy. So there's a little bit of difference there. I think that Heuermann is probably a better planner, and Hazlitt is much more impulsive, it seems to me, probably. He's probably not planning well, and he's probably making decisions on the spur of this, you know, the moment. So there are differences too, clearly. Age, Heuermann's older. Heuermann was able to pull off these crimes for a longer period of time, it seems.
Yeah. Yeah. Or not get arrested as soon. Although, you know, at the same time, again, we haven't seen any more, you know, charges for Tim either. So.
Right.
Right. But they both seem to be living a different life. I'm sure that the son's mother would have never let her son over there if she had known what Tim was really up to, and his ex-wife. And I don't believe that Rex Heuermann's wife knew what was going on, in my opinion. You know, people are actually asking, John, about drugs and Tim, and then Janine. So someone said, do you think there were drugs involved, prescription or otherwise? And then Janine said, wasn't the ex reported to be an addict? This is actually really interesting information. It was not reported that the ex-wife was an addict from anyone but Tim himself. Tim wrote a letter from the court, and John and I have been discussing this letter too, where he actually mentioned his wife is a drug addict, but he was just really, really upset that she, after his arrest and charges, after TJ escaped, she put in a restraining order and made sure that, you know, he could not see their son. And that really angered him.
Hidden True Crime is prepping to record live podcasts on the road while meeting many of you along the way. We want to connect to all of our gems without language being a barrier. Enter the most trusted language learning program, Rosetta Stone. It immerses you in a language you're learning, and it's available on desktop or app, perfect for on-the-road learning. We're excited to learn Spanish, French, Italian, Korean, and more. Excited to speak, listen, and think in a new language through an intuitive process. First with words, then phrases, then sentences. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Join with us. Do not put off learning that language. No better time than right now to get started. For a limited time, Hidden True Crime listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today. Many think you need a lot of money to invest, but Acorns makes it easy to start automatically saving and investing for your future. In fact, you can get started and invest with Acorns with just your spare change. Acorns recommends an expert-built portfolio that fits you and your money goals, then automatically invests your money for you. And now, Acorns is putting their money into your future. Open an Acorns Later IRA and get up to 3% match on new contributions. That's extra money for your retirement. For me, investing often gets put off because it doesn't seem urgent, but it's important to start even with a small amount. Head to acorns.com/hiddentruecrime or download the Acorns app to start saving and investing for your future today. Paid non-client testimonial. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Investing involves risk. Acorn Advisors, LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorn.com/hiddentruecrime. I've been experiencing symptoms that many of us at this age experience due to hormonal imbalances. And if anyone can relate, I do recommend Hormone Harmony. Hormone Harmony is a supplement for women going through perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause, but it's for any woman that has symptoms of hormonal imbalances. It has been a tremendous help for me. And the company Happy Mammoth that created Hormone Harmony, they're dedicated to making our lives easier. And that means using science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. These symptoms can include night sweats, racing thoughts and low moods, poor sleep, feeling exhausted all the time. Yes, Hormone Harmony has helped me with all of these things. And the biggest benefit, feeling like myself again. And that's what women mention over and over in their reviews. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com. Just use our code HiddenTrueCrime at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code HiddenTrueCrime for 15% off today.
Here are some of the things in that letter. He has asked Jackson County Family Court Judge to forego a suspension of his visitation rights with his young son. But because the charges are against him are so serious, Hazlett's ex-wife, who has current custody of their child, filed a temporary sole custody and temporary block of Mr. Hazlett's visitation rights. This is what he says. He says, to support this claim, I will first offer my present detainment as a significant barrier of protection from physical harm if such a threat even existed. I am currently being held and have no intention of attempting to seek reduction or of posting said bail, as I have no assets and to do so, and I will not do so with any future third party. He continues, and for anecdotal evidence, let me personally say that I would never, ever harm my son. My son is my only purpose for life. I love him more than words can describe. It breaks my heart that I am not there for him right now as I should be. The mere accusation or belief by anyone that I would, and then it's cut off, and we assume he says, harm my son, we can assume he says is a preposterous idea. I'm going to put those words at the end of his quote because it is cut off. Hazlett claims, according to the Excelsior Citizen, that his ex-wife is motivated purely by the potential for monetary gain from the reduction of child support and the benefits of tax breaks. He said news outlets have portrayed him unfairly, presenting a one-sided narrative that is improper, unjust, and unfair, and should not be used as evidence against him and in family courts. And he threw out a lot of things about her, including that she was a drug addict. But I want to say this is really interesting. It was originally reported that when TJ escaped, TJ did tell police that Timothy had told her that he was taking his son to school and that he would be right back. And the school is about 2 minutes away. So that makes sense. It was early in the morning. But what actually happened, and we've confirmed this, this is insider information that we have, that's not where he was going. His dog had gotten out, and that's why he came back home. But when he was charged, and then police happened to be there, and they arrested him for a dog out of the yard while they processed what to do about, you know, to get charges for TJ. But what we learned is that when he was arrested, he had a vial of urine around his leg, Timothy Hazlett did. And that implying that he was actually on his way, so it was suggested he was unemployed at the time, that he was on his way to a job interview. And so we know what that means, right? I mean, he realizes he's probably going to have to do a urine test for drugs, which then would mean he's using someone else's urine, which means he's likely on drugs, which is why he wants to use somebody else's urine. I don't think I'm reaching there with assuming that. So while we haven't necessarily heard of specific drugs or what was going on, there likely seems to be a drug issue. And then it's ironic that he's blaming his wife, his ex-wife, for the drug issue when he's got urine, somebody else's urine around his leg when he's arrested. What's that about?
Well, he's blaming his ex-wife for everything. So, I mean, not atypical, but in with someone like this, that's not particularly healthy. But so the letter's sort of a defense about why they should let him out, how he hasn't really committed any crimes. And it's all about custody issues. It has nothing to do with the reason he's sitting in jail. Right. Like there's almost something delusional about it. You know,
the letter's bizarre.
The letter's bizarre, right? There's something borderline. It does seem that this is someone who may not have the best orientation to reality at times. So that, you know, we've heard that there was some paranoia that he tended to be really disorganized in, you know, in the last couple of years. So I, you know, there clearly could be some issues around his thought processes and maybe some type of psychosis. I don't know for sure, but he's not, unlike Rex Huerman. I think Rex Huerman probably has a much better grasp of reality. Rex Huerman is, these are both frightening figures, but Rex Huerman is someone I think who, when he decides to commit a crime, he's going to plan it down to the most minute details, and he's going to be completely oriented and aware and present when he's committing those crimes. Whereas Timothy Hazlitt, my guess is not going to do as much planning. It's probably going to be more impulsive, and he might be on drugs when he's doing it. He's going to be more disorganized, right? Which isn't to say one or the other. I mean, it's just different personalities, both frightening.
You know, the letter, John, we read it again today as we prepared for this. You're right. It's so separate from reality. Here he is with these horrendous charges, and he's just arguing and demanding that he should still get to be able to see his son, but not just get to see his son. He doesn't end there. I want to see my son. He's saying, I demand that she bring him a certain amount of times a month, that he has visitations with a relative on my side, that I'm going to need him to see him this many times on his summer vacation, and his aunt's going to need to see him this long on his summer vacation, and that I'm going to need to be able to report him on my tax, like my taxes. I mean, it's not just, I want to see my son. It's like, this is what's going to happen, everyone, while I'm sitting here in Clay County Detention Center.
Well, he's also telling law enforcement what to do. I mean, it's completely divorced from reality in many ways, but I'm hesitant to use the term narcissistic because that's the term that's thrown around so often these days, but it's super self-absorbed. It's super self-centered at the very least, right? His perception of the world is that he somehow, that if he negotiates with law enforcement or with the DA or the prosecution over custody issues and child pain, you know, child custody pain, or, you know, pain for his child, right? So he's essentially trying to negotiate with law enforcement so that he can get released. Like, it's almost as if he's acting as if this crime never happened and the real issue is custody, which has nothing to do with the reason he's sitting in jail.
Right. People are mentioning delusional. I know you've mentioned that. And Lori Davis, I like her comment. She says control. They all have an issue with control.
Right. Control is a common theme with these types of characters because somebody like Timothy Hazlitt and Rex Huerman, and take your pick of any serial killer, they don't like to feel weak. They don't like to feel vulnerable. They don't like to feel emotions in general. So obviously their preferred method of dealing with the world is to control it and to control people's reactions and to, you know, to feel safe. That's how they feel safe, is that if they have control over people, then they don't have to be vulnerable. Then they don't have to feel afraid. They don't, like, all the things that they're trying to avoid through their behaviors and their violence. Control is the mode that allows them to circumvent all of those feelings.
Writing demanding letters while in jail is almost laughable, though.
Yeah, right.
It is extreme control, extreme everything.
Yeah, let me just mention before I forget, let me mention some other similarities and differences. I think this is an important one. That one thing about Timothy Hazlitt is that he could never keep a job. So he washed out of the Navy. I don't know why. We don't know why. But he was in the Navy a short period of time. He was discharged, didn't make it, washed out. He went from job to job for a long period of time. He did get a job with the railroad for almost 15 years, 14, 15 years. And then he was fired. And by the way, if, you know, because that's a union job, that's, it's very difficult to get fired from those types of bureaucracies, but he managed to do it. So from what we can tell from our sources, he was constantly in conflict at work. He was getting in fights with bosses, colleagues. He clearly had problems with authority. He may have been drinking at work. There was apparently a DUI involved in his dismissal. We don't know the exact details, but Tim Hazlitt was someone who couldn't stay in a relationship, couldn't keep a job, right? There were all these issues going on. Whereas Huerman, would be an example of someone who not only did he keep a job, but he started his own architectural firm. He was the boss and he was totally in control of it. So, right, a much higher level of functioning on the one hand. On the other hand, somebody like Huerman recognizes probably that with his issues and pathology and his sort of being an outcast, that he would much prefer to be in charge. So he starts his own firm precisely because he doesn't want other people to tell him what to do. He wants to be the authority figure. Whereas a guy like Tim Haslett, who doesn't have Huerman's education, sort of goes from job to job, and he's not functional enough or help mentally, you know, he doesn't have enough mental health to succeed at work, and he keeps getting fired. And so he's got this constant instability wherever he goes, whether it's work, relationships, right? He can't find any stability in his life. And perhaps some of that has to do with the fact that his mental health is deteriorating. Maybe there are issues that look more like psychosis as time goes by. I don't know. I mean, how old was he? He was in his 30s, right?
Yeah, 30. I wanted to say 36 and I bit my tongue because I like to be factual.
Yeah,
I think didn't know if that was exact age he was arrested, but that so was what I be, have in my brain.
There could be some mental health issues with him that are accelerating and are becoming worse. And he knows that. And he's really having a hard time functioning or, you know, staying in a job or whatever. So it could have been a situation where all of the mental health issues eventually caught up with them.
You know, that one thing, I have a big question for you, John.
Okay.
But I don't know if I should, do you still have some more information here? I didn't know if you were done yet, but I wanted to move on to this bit of insider info that we have.
Okay. Yeah.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
I really want to ask you about it. So we have one more clip to play from Bishop Caldwell.
Okay.
And then I want to talk about what we've discovered since then that you're only going to hear here on Hidden True Crime. And it's about Timothy Haslett. And I hope that we can discuss this here because it's.
There was clothes found. Other women's clothes found on the premises. If you find a bunch of other women's clothes, where are the women that those belong to?
I first want to agree with Bishop Caldwell. Point well taken. If there are women's clothes, where are the other women? How many women were there? I agree, but I'm going to take this women's clothing thing a little bit further. We have been talking to people and someone specifically who even saw some of the underwear that Timothy was wearing one day. And that it was female underwear. It was lacy. These were not, this was not a pair of underwear bought at Costco. Let's say that. This was intimate underwear. It was even suggested that one day someone might have even seen him wearing a thong, but that it was lacy, it was red, it was colored, that he wore women's underwear. I don't even know where to start. And I guess, yeah, I don't even have a question. The whole stating that blows my mind because that just throws things. I mean, Kai Ocean is saying one of my thoughts, this dude wore his trophy women's underwear.
Yeah. That was actually when Lauren brought that to my attention, that was actually the first question I asked her. Well, was he wearing the underwear after
the room was built? So he built the room in 2020. We don't know his crimes, but this was 22.
There's a lot of potential issues there. I guess it could be, I agree with Kai, it could be very much like a trophy in the sense that it's a reminder to him of his power and his ability to murder people. And so that's right. He's like, there's a sense in which if it is his victim's underwear, I think there's a sense in which this is about possession. He's trying to possess them in some way. And the way that Dahmer, I mean, this is a different pathology, obviously, but and the way that Dahmer consumes his victims, feeling like he wants them to be a part of him, this is would be like Tim Hazlitt's way of doing that. If it's the victims, if it's not the victim's underwear, if this is just underwear he's purchasing from Walmart, let's say, then it might be a little bit of a different presentation. So that in that case, it might be more of a fetish. We talked last time when we talked about Huerman, we talked about paraphilias. Paraphilias are deviant sexual behavior. So this could be a paraphilia. A lot of times there's an intersection between paraphilias, personality disorders, and sexual homicides. And so I think here you're seeing the possibility, like Huerman. So that was true of Huerman. I think you're seeing here the possibility that these elements are intersecting, that you're getting a paraphilia or some type of deviant sexual behavior or fantasies, let's say, and you're combining that with some type of mental health issues or maybe even a personality disorder. And that can be a really combustible combination. That can be, you know, a dangerous combination. And so you've got the same elements are lining up that kind of lined up for Huerman and, you know, setting up the potential for lust murder, depending on my guess is that if that is a type of paraphilia here, my guess is that there's probably many more behind that. So you're probably just scratching the surface there.
You were recently reading something that explains that serial killers are very rare now. That there are not a lot of serial killers. And while we don't know what charges Timothy Hazlitt will ever face, I suspect he is one. I suspect that he is one or was trying to be one. How about that? I think you have to have killed at least three people. TJ escaped.
Right. I mean, with Timothy Hazlitt, right, she escaped, so she wasn't murdered. But I mean, certainly you'd have to say that the intent was to murder.
Maybe someone that was on his way to being a serial killer, a potential serial killer.
You have these barrels. You have multiple barrels. I'm sure he doesn't have those up for decoration purposes. I'm sure he's not, you know, I'm sure he's not trying to augment his bachelor pad with these beautiful blue barrels, right? So
right.
The barrels have a purpose. They serve a function. And, you know, whether, unfortunately, I think in the Hazlitt case, if there is acid involved, and if he took a page out of Breaking Bad, out of Walter White's playbook, then he may have destroyed a lot of evidence. And so it's possible he could be a serial killer, and you never know it unless he confesses. He doesn't seem like the type of guy who's going to give you a confession.
Right, right. And why is it that serial killers, I mean, this is a good thing. Serial killers are rare, but you were almost telling me that they've become more so.
Well, so I read an article in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago that was really fascinating that argued that the number of serial killers or serial killings is down dramatically because of the increases in technology. So with door cams and police cams and cameras everywhere and the improved analysis of DNA and with cell phone technology improved, like it's so much harder to get away with crimes these days, especially. So if you're a serial killer, that means you have multiple victims over a period of time. So, you know, every time you commit a crime, you're leaving behind evidence, you're leaving behind clues, trace evidence. There's just no way you can commit a crime without impacting the crime scene to some degree. And so serial killers, the first time they kill, it might be hard to identify, obviously, but as they leave behind signatures and their MOs become more apparent, it becomes more likely they're going to be caught because more DNA is available, because there might be cameras. And so I think, and because you can make more mistakes. So I think serial killers, although they may want to engage in that behavior, apparently they're aware of the fact that forensics has improved dramatically, that the technology has improved, that there's more cameras out there watching, there's better ways to analyze DNA, contact DNA is more prevalent, right? So the number of serial killers has gone down dramatically. So I think this is an interesting case. He certainly tends to fit the profile of someone who would commit multiple murders over time, and certainly based on what his first victim said, that that she was lucky that she got away, that the other people didn't, you know, implies that there's multiple people.
I want to quote her. I want to quote her. As tight-lipped as law enforcement has been, we know that she stated, my friends, friends. Just like Tony Caldwell, Bishop Caldwell stated, my friends did not make it. And it is my suspicion that we have found one of those friends. Where is the other one?
Right. So he certainly looks like someone who tends to fit that profile. Whether the evidence bears that out, I don't know.
And Excelsior Springs police chief agrees, where he stated, I believe he believes that it keeps him up at night, and he believes he's done a lot more than we know about. Here it is. This is one of those cases that keeps you up at night. Excelsior Springs police chief Gregory Dull told the Star during an interview. My personal opinion from the Excelsior Springs police chief, Tim has done more than what he's already charged for, he said of Haslett. But being able to prove that is a totally different thing. So we are going with evidence. We are going with what law enforcement have said. We're going with what the victim said. So it's fair that we're also speculating there.
Right, exactly. So, but again, he clearly tends to fit that profile. And if you presume that his goal was to kill the first victim, then you already have two victims there. I mean, he didn't, so you can't charge him with that. But you have to look at his intent. And then to presume that since this room was built in 2020, that these were the only two women he targeted over a period of over 2 years seems hard to believe. So I don't know. I hope they dig a little deeper and try to connect him to some other missing women or victims as well, because
I hope so too.
He most definitely fits the profile of someone who would be very similar to, if not a serial killer. One of our sources gave us a quote that Timothy Haslett had said to her when he was kind of in a vulnerable place. And I think the quote really kind of says it all. So I just wanted to read that. This is a direct quote from Tim Haslett. And he told this person, he said, have you ever been somewhere when you knew you weren't wanted? To me, that quote says so much about him, in the sense that I think Timothy Haslett felt like there was never any place where he was wanted, you know, and a lot of what he's doing is precisely to try to repair or remedy that feeling of not being wanted. I think if there's a motif for Timothy Haslett, it's this feeling of not being wanted and this desire to be wanted. His mother didn't want him. He wasn't close to his father. His stepmother abused him as well. Like this is a guy who was constantly rejected. He was bullied. He felt like an outcast, a loner. He didn't feel wanted. He didn't feel loved. And that's always a prescription for problems later, especially if you combine it with the type of fear he apparently had, the hatred he has, the racism. When you combine all that, you know, watch out, get out of the way.